Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's the sound of the humpback whale. Philip Hoare established his passion for whales in a book called The Whale, In Search of the Giants of the Sea. His newest book is called The Sea Inside, a mix of acutely observed notes on nature, literary history, memoir, and travelogue of a year-long journey to rediscover the sea. Philip Hoare swims with whales in the Azores, dolphins in Tasmania, observes birds in Sri Lanka, and reflects on the tawdry beauty of the English coast. It is a love letter to the sea, with many steps off the path for unpredictable and amusing references about the animals, birds, and the humans who depend upon it. Philip Hoare, thank you so much for being here.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
In the epigraph to your book, you quote from the great Anglo-Saxon poem, The Seafarer. Can you recite that?
Even now my heart journeys beyond its confines, and my thoughts over the sea, across the whale's domain, travel afar the regions of the earth.
There's a lot of longing in that, a lot of restlessness. Is that what set you off on this year-long journey?
You are never comfortable with the sea. We were talking about this the other day. I've just come from Provincetown, where I've been doing a lot of whale watching. And we were talking on the boat that, you know, you're always on that moment of anticipation of seeing a whale. That's extraordinary, of course. And then the moment of seeing one is a kind of moment of transcendence. And then the moment afterwards is kind of, oh, when are we going to see it again? But also, you know, the sea is never comfortable. I mean, I never learnt to swim until I was 25 because I was scared witless of the sea, even though I grew up in a port city in Southampton. And I suppose it's because the sea can give life and it can take life and it doesn't really care.
Hmm.
You know, you can't make an alliance with the sea. It's never a friend. There's a temporary sort of truce. But beyond that, you do not trust it, really.
I want to go back to this idea of the vastness of the sea. You remember the many conspiracy theories that developed when the Malaysia Airlines 470 went down. I mean, just reminded of people how huge and mysterious the sea is. And people were so shocked about not being able to locate something as big as a plane inside of the sea. I'm wondering what that shock revealed to you.
Oh, I just thought that was extraordinary because we believe we have extended our dominion over a sort of every square kilometre of the earth. You know, we can't believe that there are parts of the world that exist where we do not have control. So that notion of, you know, who does the sea belong to? Does the sea have a history? Does it have a culture? When increasingly now we're thinking that whales, for instance, have a culture. Whales and dolphins have a culture. It remains an enigma, even in the 21st century.
Well, let's get to the whales that you were just talking about. Your passion for them is just infectious. I learned so much about them. Now, you swim with sperm whales on a shoal off of the Azores. Tell us what you hear.
Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary. I think to slightly backtrack from your question is the notion that until the 1960s, we didn't realise these animals had a voice, really. And that's partly why we got away with doing what we did to whales. But in the Azores, where the sperm whale sleeps and inhabits this extraordinary depth of water, if you go just half a mile out from the shores of the Azores, it falls to 3 miles in depth. These are incredibly profound waters in the mid-Atlantic. And when you lower a hydrophone in the water there, you don't hear song, you hear...
Louder than a jet engine,
Louder than a jet engine. And, of course, sonar, which is what they're using, is the only way of hunting the food. But it's not only for hunting. It's for communication as well that the sperm whales use use those clicks. And they are, in fact, incredibly intelligent animals. The frontal lobes of a sperm whale's brain are highly convoluted. There's a lot of surface area there. And we know now that that's... makes them capable of tool use. And believe it or not, whales and dolphins do use tools.
What kind of tools?
Oh, well, they'll use, I mean, dolphins will use sponges to dig up food, prey. They will actually, dolphins will actually present potential partners with bouquets of seaweed, which is rather romantic. But sperm whales, we know, they communicate like dolphins with these click systems. And scientists now believe that, you know, not only they are communicating, but they might exhibit a sense of collective individuality. These animals who assemble in huge pods, but express themselves within those pods individually. To the extent that there's one great scientist, Hal Whitehead, working up at Dalhousie, Nova Scotia, posits the notion that whales, sperm whales, might have developed a sense of their existential self.
Yeah, your description of swimming them, it's actually a very sensual thing, a very beautiful experience, and huge and scary at the same time.
Of course. I mean, they're the biggest predator that had ever lived. Yeah. I mean, they're massive animals. But I've now learned that actually I have never felt so safe in the ocean as I have when I'm with cetaceans, almost as though they're a kind of protection in a way. And that's kind of not fantasy, really. Only 2 weeks ago, we had a swimmer off New Zealand who was saved from a shark by a dolphin. We think there is some kind of association that cetaceans recognize us as fellow mammals. Hmm. They know we are like them.
Philip Hoare is with us. His new book is called The Sea Inside. It's about the sea which defines us and connects us and separates us. Well, some of these stories of connection between humans and animals I found so fascinating. We meet St. Cuthbert, a medieval hermit who communicated with the otters and the seals, and the whales are as an extension of the dream time for the Aborigines. Has this connection, this ability to observe the intelligence of animals, which I think you do so beautifully in the book, gone the way of Aboriginal populations, fragile, tainted, removed from the modern world?
I wonder what effect human beings have had on animal culture. You know, because animals are subject to human influence right throughout history, and that's changed a lot. So, well, if you take the whale, for instance, you know, we regarded until the 1960s, you know, the whale as an industrial resource. And now we see it as a kind of environmental barometer, a symbol of ecological threat. Well, you know, out there in Provincetown, we're going to whale watch. We're going to hunt. Mm-hmm. You know, Provincetown, like New Bedford, was one of the great whaling ports of the Yankee whaling years. And now, you know, there's these boats going out there to whale watch. Well, they've got naturalists on them giving a narration over a tannoy system. Well, the whales, whose ultimate sense is sound, must hear those narrations. And they must hear these naturalists, and they give names to specific humpback whales, for instance. So a whale called Anchor, for instance, who's come back with her third calf from the Caribbean, the migration to the Caribbean. So the naturalist is giving this narration. Well, who's to say? I mean, your dog recognises its name. A whale, I'm afraid to say, is much more intelligent than your dog. Or who's to say the whale isn't reacting to its name? Who's to say the whale is now not performing? You know, how has the whale's culture changed in relationship to human culture? For instance, the grey whales of California were called devilfish because they fought back so ferociously against the hunters off Baja California. In fact, we realised they were doing that because they were protecting the calves. The hunters would kill the calf first and then that would draw in the adults. But now those same whales come right up to boats to be petted and patted.
I've done it myself.
Have you indeed?
The Bahia Magdalena in Baja California.
Wonderful. Well,
I mean, amazing experience.
I see in that a kind of forgiveness. I mean, that is anthropomorphic in a way. But, you know, these whales, I mean, grey whales we know to live to at least 70 years. You know, sperm whales are 100 years. Bowhead whales, 300 years.
Wow.
These are animals that live in excess of our lives. That's what makes them so difficult to study in many ways. So they have seen humans come and go, centuries of humans come and go. All around the world, animals have reacted to human depredation and hunting. You know, they just do. And animal culture, which is passed down, especially in whales, as in elephants, as in many primates, is passed down matrilineally. That knowledge is passed down through the generation. We don't know. In 100 years' time, are we going to look around and say, why didn't you realise? Why didn't you know? What on earth were you doing? we've made huge steps. I mean, one of the great things the International Whaling Commission's moratorium on hunting whales back in 83, which was implemented in 1986, we're now seeing many more whales coming back to the coasts of Australia, of America, of Europe. You know, I mean, there's a 10% increase in humpback whale calves off the eastern coast of Australia now. This is, we should pat ourselves on the back for this. You know, we have done something good, you know.
So returning population. And at the end of your book, you return home to Southampton. I wonder if, like the seafarer, do your thoughts always go back out to the sea?
It's never far from me. I was in my little attic room in Provincetown the night before last, and I was about to go to sleep, and the sea was rushing up against the bulkhead below my window, and the moon was nearly full, and it was shining on the sea, and I realised I couldn't go to sleep. Climbed down out of my bed, down into the sea, and like swam at midnight, and it was just magical, and I realised, I think this is my home, actually.
Philip Hoare, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much, Virginia.
Philip Hoare's new book is called The Sea Inside. You can see some of the terrific reviews of the book and also a list of where he'll be reading around the New England area at wordofmouthradio.org. We continue to ride the high seas. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll visit an underwater sculpture park and find out how works of art are helping to save the world's most vulnerable coral reefs.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you want to visit the Vatican Museum to see the Sistine Chapel or the Metropolitan Museum of Art to see Van Gogh's self-portrait with a straw hat, be prepared to wait in line for hours. If you'd like to see the work of artist Jason DeCaris Taylor, be prepared to wear scuba gear. In 2006, DeCaris founded and created the world's first submerged sculpture park off the coast of Grenada. And his latest creation, Musa, is a collection of over 500 underwater sculptures off the coast of Cancun. But his works are as much for sea life as they are for art lovers. In fact, they were designed to promote coral growth. His work is compiled in a new book, The Underwater Museum, and I'm pleased it brings him to Word of Mouth. Jason DeCaris Taylor, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. Nice to join you.
Now, most of us will not see your sculpture, so let's start with your latest collection off the coast of Cancun. How many sculptures, what size, and how deeply are they submerged?
First of all, I think there's around 500. I just completed installing them around 4 months ago. And the idea is that it creates this sort of monumental artificial reef that encourages fish, encourages divers, and it's just a great place for tourists to visit.
So these are all human figures, or, you know, figures that look like humans. How big are they?
Yes, they're all life-size. So I actually cast living people in plaster and alginate. And then I use these casts to make a special marine cement sculpture that will then be installed.
How deeply are they submerged, and how do they stay on the ocean floor?
They're all around 30 feet deep. We actually have two sites in Cancun, a very shallow water one for snorkelers and then a deeper water one for divers. The shallow one is around 9 feet, and then the one for divers is around 30 feet. But we also have glass-bottom boats to visit as well, so you don't actually have to get wet to see the pieces.
Well, I'm just asking, trying to paint a picture for the audience, that you're swimming along in this beautiful blue sea and you see 500 figures sort of lined up along the bottom of the sea floor. Does the museum get many visitors?
It gets a lot of visitors, yes. It's actually situated in the National Marine Park, and that gets around 800,000 people a year visiting it each year. And that's actually how the project was initiated. They were finding that this sort of immense pressure on the natural reef systems was causing a lot of problems. So they wanted to provide an alternative that would sort of discharge some of these people. And currently around 200,000 to 300,000 people go to this museum. But it's such a vast space that I don't think it's ever overcrowded.
Well, you are drawing more people to a fragile ecosystem, but at the same time, you're kind of creating an ecosystem. So tell us about this. These sculptures, they have to be ecologically sound. You mentioned you cast this. What medium do you work with?
I mainly work with cement, a special type of marine cement. And yes, all the sculptures are kind of tailor-made for marine life. So the textures of the sculptures are sort of rough so that corals can actually adhere to them. They're pH neutral, so they don't cause any damage to the environment. And they're also drilled into the sea floor so that in any kind of hurricane or storm that they actually don't move and cause any damage.
Did you collaborate with scientists or conservationists when you were coming up with this project or even this process for MUSA?
Yes, very much so. It's been sort of an immense amount of work, working with local biologists, working with artificial reef companies to try and find, you know, exactly the right sizes for the creatures to live in, the right sort of layout. Little things just by, you know, the museum is actually situated down current of the natural reef, and that allows the coral polyps after the spawning to actually drift down current and then attach themselves to the sculptures. So definitely, yeah, a lot of research goes into that part.
So I'm looking at one of your pieces from the book, beautiful full color photographs in the book, but a lot of them in black and white, which gives a completely different effect. The one I'm looking at is called Holy Man. Now, this is situated 4 meters below the surface. It's got all of these holes dug into it. Tell us about the creative process there. What were you doing?
That's quite an interesting piece because it actually uses live coral that's been propagated underwater. So what happens is there's a coral nursery in Cancun that is actually growing small fragments of coral. And we take fragments from that nursery and then divide them, split them up a bit like you take cuttings from a plant. And then we actually install them, glue them onto the sculpture surface in those holes. And the idea is that over time, that these sort of branches, they're called staghorn coral because they look like the horns of a stag. They're actually sort of all sort of nest together and become a complete colony of coral.
How much do you keep these kind of habitats in mind when you're creating a piece?
A lot.
Is this the guide? I mean, is this what you're trying to do altogether?
Yes, very much so. You know, a lot of it is sort of looking at, you know, the natural reefs, what's growing, what's, you know, what's established, and then taking those and what's endangered. One particular in sculpture actually uses Gorgonian fan coral. And we are finding that a lot of the tropical storms were dislodging these fan corals and they were dying on the reef. It's a completely natural process. But we then took those fragments and repopulated them into the these wings of these figures and allowed them to grow. And it's worked quite well. They've rescued them and they're now living.
We're speaking with the artist Jason DeCaris Taylor. He's got a new book out called The Underwater Museum. He creates works of art that are submerged under the sea and then become coral reefs, habitats, places for plant life, animal life to gather underwater. Early on, you were a graffiti artist as well. Do you see any kind of parallels between your current work and that street art?
A little bit. It sounds, quite different on principle, but there are some similarities. I mean, when I was young, I would be the one that was sort of painting walls and randomly changing things. But obviously, when they're underwater, I'm actually the person that's just sort of putting down the white wall, and it's the sort of it's up to nature and the marine organisms actually do the sort of colonizing or defacing or organic changing.
Yeah, I guess you're giving them over to the elements on some level.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm one of the sort of lucky sculptors in some way that I actually don't have to do any finishing on my sculptures, you know. It's just left to its own devices.
Well, as well as serving a purpose of creating a home for life underwater, we also see this series called Bankers, for example. We see a sculpture of a man in a suit burying his head in the sand, particularly effective because it is in the sand at the seafloor. A very overweight man staring at a television while surrounded by this universe of wonder. Is there something more that you're saying than I just want to provide beautiful marine life?
Yes. I mean, a lot of the works, they're all about sort of humans living in a kind of symbiosis with nature, kind of portraying how we're sort of divorcing ourselves from nature and how we're detaching ourselves from our surroundings and in particular the sea. You know, the sea is obviously underwater, is not in everybody's lives all the time, and it's quite easily forgotten. with statistics so frighteningly bad about coral reefs. And, you know, the Caribbean, for example, I think has lost already 80% of its natural coral reefs. And that's a very frightening statistic. And I think it's really important that, you know, more people are engaged with our oceans and finding out what's actually happening.
Jason Dakaris-Taylor, thank you for your time.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Jason Dakaris-Taylor, an artist, an underwater naturalist, and a photographer. His submerged sculptures have been compiled in a stunning new book called The Underwater Museum. And if you don't have scuba gear, fear not. You can see photos of Jason's underwater works on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now we'll glide up to the surface. When Word of Mouth continues, we join a group of English fishermen who recently landed a $1.6 million contract, not for the day's catch, but for singing sea shanties.
Oh, yeah. I want to go home.
We'll hit it when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
So hoist up the jumbies. Hoist up the
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The sea is inspiration for works of art, epic novels, and song. For more than 15 years, the Fishermen's Friends have been singing sea shanties as a group in Port Isaac, Cornwall. During the summer, the 10-men group give free concerts in the Old Harbor, drawing crowds of 3,000 or more. The picturesque village has been highlighted in films and TV shows, most recently the Doc Martin series. But the Fishermen's Friends remain the heart of local culture. And now, with a $1.6 million recording contract, the group is gaining worldwide attention. Producer DeMay Roberts visited with the singers at their favorite pub in Port Isaac.
When I first heard the Fishermen's Friends, I was struck by the wall of sound that marks their harmonies.
Come on, you know, hopers, you jokers and rogues. We're on the road to nowhere, let's find out where it goes. It might be a ladder to the stars, who knows. Come on, you know, hopers, you jokers and
Most of the men grew up together in the Cornish village of Port Isaac. They started singing Christmas carols and sea shanties just for fun, but they soon became so popular they were drawing thousands to their free summer concerts. I met with 8 members of the group at their headquarters, the Golden Lion Pub near the Old Harbour, which the town calls the Platte.
My name's Julian Brown, and I'm a fisherman.
I'm John McDonald. I'm a builder in this village.
Billy Hawkins. I ran the pottery in Port Isaac.
John Brown. I live in the village. Part-time fisherman.
Trevor Grills, a builder, born in the village, live in the village, everything in the village.
I'm John Nethbridge, and I'm the only one that don't live in the village. I live in St. Cue, about 4 miles away.
Peter Rowe, old and retired.
I'm John Cleave. I'm Peter's next-door neighbour, so I look after him.
At 78, Peter Rowe is the elder statesman of the group. He says men in Cornwall love to sing.
The Cornish do have a tradition, and you can go to nearly small town, big town, and find a group of guys who are just as good as us.
John Cleave says most of them were in choirs when they were growing up. The group doesn't have a director. Usually someone sings a chorus or two.
And within 10 minutes you can tell if everyone else wants to sing it or not. It's a bit of an acid test, and, you know, sometimes it can take a little longer to get through. Sometimes you pick songs up right away, and sometimes it's readily apparent that you should never have brought this song along, and I'll get my coat then.
What they do agree on, says John Brown, is the type of music.
All our sea shanties are to do with the sea and to work with the hauling of sails, hauling up the anchor up, and various little jobs on board. But it'd be usually be a gang of people working together.
Peter Rowe demonstrates a song about winches on a sailing ship.
Stamp and go is pulling and stamping at the same time to get your balance right. Is that correct, boy?
Yeah.
Pulling and stamp and go. Stamp and go, stamp and go. You're pulling on a rope, see, to all whatever act you're taking.
We're making money with this sound.
Rowling winches, oh. Rowling down and stamp and go. Rowling winches, oh.
Woo!
Rattling down and stamp and go, rattling winches, oh.
In the hold this gear must go,
rattling winches, oh.
For Mr. Mate has told me so,
rattling winches, oh. Rattling down and stamp and go, rattling.
The songs may be upbeat, but they document the real danger fishermen face, says John Brown.
Fishing is still the most dangerous occupation in the world. Obviously, you fall overside, and if you haven't got a life jacket on, within 10 minutes, you will drown. But you could drown in a harbour. If you can't grab hold of something, you'll drown in 10 minutes.
His brother Julian Brown says that a quota system for fish forces the fishermen to throw dead fish back into the ocean. He worries about the decline of the industry.
Well, there just isn't enough money to cover the cost. The price of fuel is rising all the time, which makes it more difficult. And with the restrictions about what you can land, that makes it difficult. No, it's for the last 20 or 30 years, it's just been on a downward spiral.
Do you worry that your son is going into this?
That's why I try to keep pushing him away.
Yet the men say their children don't seem eager to leave Port Isaac, and neither are they, says John Brown.
We've all lived here for the best part of 50 years, and none of us have wanted to move away, or we've moved away but always come back. And you look out the window there, and this is what it's all about. It's a better community, but all your friends together, and living and working in a little village. The children's children grew up together, and our children's children have grown up together, and it's just absolutely fantastic.
Still, their popularity often draws the fishermen's friends away from home. Last year, they signed on with the Universal Music Group. Then they performed at the prestigious Royal Festival and Royal Albert Halls in London, as well as the world-famous Glastonbury Festival. Trevor Grill says they never expected this.
When we first started, we said we'll give it 2 years, and it's kind of going on. It's a bit like being on the crest of a wave, like surfing, I imagine it. You're on the top of the wave, and you're just going along with it. We'll just take it as far as it goes.
Are you cueing a Beach Boys song, Trevor?
For we sail on the sloop, John B, my grandpappy and me, over the seven seas we did roll.
The fishermen's friends ride that wave this summer, giving concerts in Port Isaac and around England. I'm Dime Roberts, Port Isaac.
Well, I feel so broke up.
Oh, yeah.
I want to go.
To find out more about the fishermen's friends, you can visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
I said the jumbies. See how the mainsail sails.
Next up, one consequence of overpopulation and growing global economies, demand for fish. Can sea life be sustainably harvested? When Word of Mouth continues, some innovative approaches to aquaculture.
Well, I feel so broke up.
Oh, yeah.
I want to go up.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today, we are hitting the open ocean, learning about some of its myths and meanings and challenges. Now to its shrinking bounty. With the world's population at 7 billion and rising, the demand for high-protein foods is also on the rise. According to a study released yesterday from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, fish consumption has risen from an annual average of 22 pounds per person in the 1960s to nearly double that in 2012. And that number is expected to rise another 35% in the next 20 years. Here's the problem. Where will all that fish come from? And can those demands be met sustainably? Joel Bourne wrote about farming fish for the June issue of National Geographic. Among other things, his article revealed the surprising statistic that in 2012, aquaculture exceeded beef production. I asked him what is pushing that demand upward.
We've got seafood's reputation as a much healthier type of food than, say, beef or pork or even chicken. You've also got growing economies in Asia, India and China in particular, who like seafood, eat a lot of it, and they're driving those numbers up. So seafood has always been typically more expensive than some of these other meats. So the incredible demand is just pushing those production numbers up.
But at the same time, the catch of wild fish has stagnated. Why? Is that just overfishing?
Absolutely. We've been pounding wild fish since the end of, I guess, World War II, when we really started to get small vessels with diesel engines, and then when all the great electronics came on board that even recreational fishers like myself use now, it makes it a lot easier to catch a lot more fish a lot more quickly. So the wild stocks of fish have pretty much plateaued. We've had the same amount since about the mid-1990s, and with the demand expected to increase more than 35% over the next couple of decades, all that new fish supplies are going to have to come from aquaculture.
Well, and as it is now, it looks like the U.S. is importing 90% of its seafood. around 2% of which is inspected by the FDA. The other completely unregulated?
Well, regulated but not inspected very closely. You know, there's this old adage that you go to the seafood market and you could smell it if the fish was bad, so you didn't need to worry about inspections. Unfortunately, with aquaculture and in some cases wild caught fish, that's not the case anymore. These contaminants that they're finding in there, you know, are concerning.
Well, Joel, even when we hear the words farmed fish, many people do think of the overcrowded industrial farms here on land, not to mention, you know, the salmon pens that we've been hearing about for years. You found a number of people in aquaculture today trying to avoid the mistakes of factory farming of, you know, pigs, pork and poultry and beef, for example. How so? What are they doing?
Well, we tried to look at a couple of different industries that seem to show the best way for us to move forward. One of them, is, of course, is moving all these fisheries on land. These look almost very similar to the CAFOs that you see with pigs, where you've got, you know, everything crowded into a warehouse with a lot of fish in a very small space. However, fish, especially fish like tilapia, actually like to be fairly close together. They're schooling fish. They don't seem to mind the density quite so much. And because of their feed conversion ratios, they're very efficient. And you can reduce the impacts. So you can treat the sewage that comes out of them. So that was one particular method. The other we looked was going way offshore, off into the offshore waters off the coast of Panama, where one particular company is trying to basically do what Jacques Cousteau said we had to do back in the 60s and 70s, really farm the oceans.
Let's dig into those a little bit. You mentioned CAFOs. I just want to clarify, concentrated animal feeding operations. These are these big, huge industrial farms that spew out a lot of waste. First, to the land fishing, the land aquaculture example, off the Blue Ridge Mountains in Martindale, Virginia, of all places. Now, what are they farming there?
Well, they've got one of the largest indoor fish farms in the world, and they're growing tilapia right next to a NASCAR speedway. it's hysterical. So they've got this native of the Nile, this fast-growing fish that's it's an omnivore. So they feed it mostly grain, and it's an incredibly intensive process, but it's tightly controlled to keep diseases out, and they've been very successful with it. They've been doing it for about 20 years now. It's been so successful, the owner has been asked to build these things in places like Egypt and Africa, where they really have a serious need for more fish protein.
How do they keep them disease-free? I mean, the photograph from your article show them overflowing with tilapia.
You know, it's amazing. He's got a water treatment system and an oxygenation system that's sort of like a water treatment system for a small town. So the fish are constantly bathed in ozonated water that keep them alive. And they live to eat, and that's what they do. Mm.
Joel Bourne is with us. He's a contributing writer for National Geographic. He's written an article called How to Farm Better Fish. It's in the June issue of National Geographic. Well, let's go to the other end of things, off land, Open Blue. This is in Panama. Biggest operation, I believe, open ocean fish farm in the world. And it's owned by an American, Brian O'Hanlon, third-generation fishmonger from Long Island. Why isn't it in the U.S.?
Well, you know, Brian's got an interesting story. He tried to do a fish farm in Puerto Rico and had a small experimental farm there for many years. He could not get a commercial license from the Puerto Rican authorities, which, of course, use the same regulations as they do in the United States. And because of the competition for our coastal zone, as well as sort of hardcore opposition from commercial fishing guys, the wild fish fishermen, we have not been regulatorily, at least, very friendly toward aquaculture in the United States. Hmm. He was unable to get permits to expand his operation, and finally, after 5 years of trying, just gave up. He found a place in Panama. They said, come on down. The government was very open and friendly to him as long as he employed Panamanians, which he does. And so he moved there, I think, in the late 2000s, before 2010, 2007, something like that, and has been expanding ever since.
Now, what are they farming there?
These are cobia. These are a saltwater species that are very common amongst recreational fishermen in the South, but they've never been caught commercially because they don't school like other fish. but they're delicious. My friends and I catch them down here in North Carolina, and they're apparently very good to farm.
But still, he's yet to turn a profit, despite demand for a high-end fish. Why not?
Well, the costs of going offshore are phenomenal. And you've got 200 guys. They go out to these farms. They're 8 miles offshore, and they have to go service them every day. So he's got a fleet of boats. He's got divers with hard hats. He's got a ocean-going tug that he has to use to move these big things around. I mean, this is major, a major operation. And so he's hoping to break even next year. And the thing about Hanlon, he's one of these guys who's on the frontier. He's got a lot of investors that are banking on him turning a profit and doing well. And if he succeeds, I think you're going to see a lot more of this type of investment around the world.
Okay, so we've looked at examples of aquaculture on land, in the ocean, polyculture. This is something on Vancouver Island. This polyculture apparently has its roots in ancient China. What is it exactly?
Well, it's really cool. It's basically where you grow several species in one particular area. You feed one. In this case, it's a sable fish, but it's also marketed as black cod.
Okay.
So this particular researcher up at University of Vancouver has taken a small experimental salmon farm, and he's feeding these one species, these black cod, but all around the farm he's put these Chinese lantern baskets of Japanese scallops, and then he's got seaweed sort of wrapped around those to collect a lot of the nutrients that are coming out of the fish waste. And underneath it, he has sea cucumbers, these echinoderms that are just ugly as can be, but the Chinese love them, and they sell them for about $1 a piece. And they're down at the very bottom of the beneath the cages, eating up any of the solids that the fish tend to leave. So essentially, he's feeding one species and growing seven others all around it.
Huh.
And it's just an extremely interesting system. And the ancient Chinese, of course, did this with carp and rice polyculture for thousands upon thousands of years. They were among the first fish farmers in the world. And this sort of rice fish type of polyculture is one of the things that sort of has sustained their diet for generations and generations. And it's coming back in China. It's becoming more and more popular in China as well.
Hmm. So he's kind of creating a more sustainable model, sounds like a more ecologically sound model, by kind of replicating the food chain. So my question to you, Joel, to be truly sustainable and low impact, what should we be eating? Should we be eating from the bottom of the seafood chain?
Well, this is my favorite question that I ask a lot of the people, whether they're at World Wildlife Fund and you know, some of the environmental groups or the Monterey Bay Aquarium. You know, what do you eat for dinner? What is the most sustainable thing that we can eat from the sea? And invariably, the first thing that comes out of the mouth is shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
Shellfish that you don't have to feed them. They're high in omega-3s. They're low in fats. They're high in protein. And they're filter feeders. So they actually clean the waterways that they're in. I can find no one who's against it or who can say bad things about it. The only concern is, of course, ocean acidification hits shellfish hard, and we're starting to see some impacts of that, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where oyster farms have had some tough times.
And they're not kosher.
Yes. That is another thing. But they are delicious.
Joel Bourne, I want to thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Joel Bourne is a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine, and his latest article is called How to Farm a Better Fish. It's in the June issue, and you can, of course, have a link to look at it. Being National Geographic, the photographs are terrific, and so is the research. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The sea offers sustenance. It can give life and take life. It can also author a welcome distraction for a group of working moms in Maine. That distraction? Surfing. Rain or shine or snow. This story comes from Katie Ricciardi of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
Suzanne Quinn never stops moving. Despite working full-time running her own PR firm, the 42-year-old mother still makes all of her family's meals. Tonight, it's Thai pork salad.
Hey, it's one of our staples.
Quinn's son, Jackson, sits at the dinner table doing homework. while her husband John makes a phone call. She separates all the ingredients into small white bowls, like they do on the Food Network. Her attention to detail is key for doing well in her professional and personal life. Despite this, she still struggles to find balance.
When you're a working mother, it's so hard because, especially if you work out of your home like I do, you feel like you're failing at both sometimes because you can't give work 100% and you can't give your family 100%. So, I mean, Jackson grew up from a very young age. If I just, like, made the sign on my neck, you know, when I was on the phone, he knew to be quiet.
One of Quinn's friends, Elise Kiley, a real estate broker with two kids, faced the same problems.
I think as women, we do so much for so many people that we want to make sure our children, if they're interested in baseball or soccer or football or ballet, we want to do whatever we can to give them unique and different experiences. Why do we not get to do those things for ourselves?
A few years ago, Keely discovered Mom's Mornings. It's a club for mothers from all over Maine. You might imagine Mom's Mornings as an adult Girl Scout meeting with knitting and cookies, and you would be wrong. A couple months ago, Keely brought Quinn with her to one of the meetings.
We drive up and it was this cloudy, rainy day. I mean, it is raining, coming down.
We were on the verge of saying, let's just go get coffee. And I said, Suzanne, are you going to go home and tell your son and your husband that you didn't go because it was raining?
And sure enough, I got out there and then I realized, funnily enough, it doesn't matter if it's raining when you're surfing because, hello, you're getting wet anyway.
And we had a ball. And she was hooked. Hooked, line, and sinker after that first time.
That's right. The group of moms meets every Tuesday to go surfing in Maine, all year round. And they love it.
People look at the surfer like, oh, you have to be this fit, young, hip person. And you can be anyone and get out in there and surf.
Nancy Boutette started the group in 2002, the same year she opened her surf shop, Aquaholics. Like most moms in the group, Boutette started surfing later in life.
I was 36 years old. Our youngest wanted a surfboard for a graduation present from middle school. We got wetsuits and everything like that, and I got a surfboard from a friend, and we all started surfing as a family.
When she tried to buy gear, though, she ran into a problem.
As a woman, when I went into a surf shop anywhere, it was pretty much, yeah, the bathing suits are over there. And then you were kind of ignored. When I first started, actually, if you went in the water, to see another woman in the water was kind of unusual. Now, we go in the water, and oftentimes there'll be like five girls out and one guy. It's kind of cool.
Boutette is the main reason for the increase in local female surfers. She started Mom's Mornings to get adult women into the water. As a mother of three, she knows that women need an outlet for themselves. This morning, five people show up at the beach, six including me. There are patches of snow from the storm last night. Boutette provides all the gear for free. Winter wetsuits, boards, even parking passes. The suits have hoods and are so thick that everyone moves like C-3PO. Boutette gives a few tips on technique and sends us into the water. Now, one thing you should know about Boutette is that she does not mess around.
Paddle hard! Paddle! Granny, paddle! Paddle, 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 paddle! Knife!
I hit myself in the nose with the board once, missed dozens of waves, and actually got up twice. My arms are killing me. Feels like I've been paddling through cement all morning. I smelled like the ocean for the rest of the day, which is one of Quinn's favorite parts about surfing.
I just like having like a reminder of the rest of the day that like I was in the ocean. It's, you know, it's October. People are raking their leaves, and I was in the ocean today surfing.
Even though she only started a few months ago, surfing has already changed Quinn's life.
Being a mom and working mom at that, there's always something to do. So you really do have to take that time for yourself so you're a decent person to be around.
For Salt Radio, I'm Katie Ricciardi.
Thank you for joining us today for our journey out to sea. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, like the best fish stories and sea shanties, the most fascinating stories get passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.